Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. Senator Bonhoff is back. And hopefully we have a reconciled fiscal note now.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me back.
So just to remind people, this is the bill we heard about temporary Minnesota care coverage for unemployed persons. And we had a fiscal note that had sort of one set of numbers from one department and another set of numbers from some assumptions from another department. And so we kind of laid it over to see if we could get them in the same range.
Madam Chair, in addition, one of the concerns that came up in our last meeting was who in fact was going to be determining eligibility, because that was where some of the costs were coming from, is when the department thought that they in fact had to add so many staff people to be determining eligibility. So I do have the A8 amendment, which clarifies who in fact will be having the responsibility for determining eligibility.
I don't have copies of it.
We don't have copies, so we'll get copies made, and maybe by then we'll have a quorum.
Very good. Thank you. And, Madam Chair, do you have the fiscal note before you?
Well, yes. We have one dated 4/14.
Yes.
So I guess that's the most recent. And is the language of the amendment incorporated in here?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. So just in looking at the fiscal note, it looks like there's additional revenue in fiscal year 10 and 11, and there's costs in 12, but the costs are covered by the additional revenue in the previous years.
Yes.
Are there any questions from any of the other committee members about the fiscal note? Well, Senator Bonhoff, why don't we just set this aside for a few minutes while we get your amendment copied, and we'll come right back to you. And why don't we take Senator Murphy next? Welcome, Senator Murphy. We need a motion to adopt the unofficial engrossment SCS 1369A-3. Senator Coring moves that, makes that motion. This will put the unofficial engrossment in front of us. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? opposed, the motion is adopted. Okay, Senator Murphy.
Madam Chair, we've been working on this fiscal note with DHS, and on page 3, the suggested change on line 33 would be to change it from 20% to 40%, and the effect of that reduces the fiscal note substantially. It would make it someplace south of 100,000.
So, like, if we made it 42%, would we be
at this level? The fiscal note all relates to loss of surcharge.
I understand that. That was a problem we had last time. But
right. And in order to get that to zero, it would raise it up to 63%. And at that point, the project would no longer be feasible to do.
Okay. Senator Sharon, do you want to move the on page 3? Line 3.33, 40%. Substitute the 20 with 40. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. And then do we have, is this fiscal note drafted to that? 40%? No. Okay. So I guess what we'll have to do at this point is to set it aside and hope in the next day or two that we get a fiscal note on the new language.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
questions?
And then, I do. And then what would be the process after that?
Well, then we see how much it costs, and we'll see if we have any money. You know, at this point, I'm still trying to get to my target, so.
Okay. You know. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'd love to have this problem. Thinking about things like this. Okay, Senator Bonhoff.
Four and a half.
Senator Bonhoff has, we had moved the A8 amendment and it was pending. And this amendment clarifies who exactly is doing the eligibility in order to reconcile the staff needs that were in the first fiscal note. So Senator Coring moves the A8 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Then we have reviewed Senator Bonhoff's new fiscal note, and there are savings to the Healthcare Access Fund in 2010 and 11, and there are some costs in 12, but those costs are offset by the revenues in the two previous years. So so with that, I would then assume that this bill could go to the full finance committee. Is there a motion?
I'll make that motion.
Senator Coring will move that Senate File 347 as amended be recommended to pass. Discussion. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to point out, and I did try to pass an amendment to take this this bill, have it come out of the Healthcare Access Fund, which is dedicated towards Minnesota Care. And as Senator Bonhoff said, that this bill is temporary, hopefully, and that's another issue. It's a fee, and our fees tend to stay in the state, and it's of great concern. And then you have a fee here that is should be coming out of the Healthcare Access Fund, which is going to have a surplus for the next few years. So I just like to make that point. I'm not going to make a motion or because we already voted on that. But this is another tax on small businesses, and it does set another tone in the business climate. And I appreciate what you're trying to do, Senator Bonhoff, but I have a lot of problems with this. I think there's one more thing we add on to the pile. Into this business climate in the state.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonhoff.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, thank you for your comments. As you know, I'm a champion of small business, and so I share your concern and wouldn't be bringing this forward if I didn't think that it was so important ultimately to the health of the business community that we keep these people insured so that we don't have unintended costs being passed on to them during this time of economic downturn. But I do appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, then those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted. Senator Dibble. And I think the reason for hearing this bill today is so that it has a tax increase in it, and it needs to get to the tax committee and has to come here first before it gets there, which, as everyone should know by now, I think is really backwards. Well, because we're going to spend some time on this tonight, and who knows whether it's wasted time or not, you know. And so I'm going to keep making my point until finally we get enough people around here to see the wisdom of changing the rules. All right. Welcome, Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I have Senate File 1990. Madam Chair, I do have the A1 amendment to offer.
Madam Chair, I'll move that.
Senator Rosen moves the A1 amendment for Senator Dibble. We're passing it out now, so we'll just wait a minute so people can see it.
And just by way of explanation, the A1 cleans up some of the provisions around the colorectal cancer prevention program, clarifies the tax increase that does not apply to the health impact fee, which is attached to taxes on tobacco. Disconnects those two. That's what the effect of the A1 amendment.
Any questions or discussion of the A1 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Well, Senate File 1990 seeks to accomplish a number of things. First and foremost, it seeks to support the efforts that we saw from Senator Sharon earlier this year, investing in the colorectal cancer screening program, which is, as we know, as I believe you had a hearing in this committee, evidence-based screening for the uninsured and underinsured. It also has the potential of leveraging federal funding on a 3-to-1 match basis. It invests in heart disease and stroke prevention and education. That also leverages significant federal funding. That includes both funding the unit at the Department of Health that deals with that issue and provides $750,000 ongoing for the Women's Health Heart Health Promotion Act. It finds needed resources outside of the healthcare access fund for the state health improvement program and provides an ongoing source of funding for that of about $47 million. And it buys back the cuts to the governor's proposed reductions in the Minnesota healthcare access fund. It gets us about $65 million, which will represent about 28,000 people who currently enjoy healthcare who would otherwise not have that health care. And, of course, it raises the resources to accomplish all of these, and by raising those resources also has a significant health effect to the positive. Of course, it raises taxes on tobacco. We know that each pack of tobacco in Minnesota costs about $8.85, and that's from studies that we know from the national group Tobacco-Free Kids. If we enact this, we know that about 44,300 kids will not become addicted and move on and become addicted adult smokers. just shy of 20,000 adult smokers will quit, and about that same number will be saved from premature smoking-related deaths. We'll be raising somewhere in the neighborhood of $90 to $100 million, and we'll save about $960 million in long-term health care costs. And also, members, as we know, the federal government just enacted an increase on tobacco. That presents, of course, some dilemma, I know, in some people's minds. But we should be cognizant of the fact that that's going to create somewhat of a shortfall, and we would lose about $40 million if we simply do nothing on this particular tax this year. It's very popular, as people are aware, the notion that we're spending so much money, putting forth so much public effort, responding to the health care problems that are faced, that we face as a result of tobacco use in Minnesota. People understand that, they get that, and feel like this is a sensible way to raise some dollars for those purposes as well as for the health benefit this action would take in and of itself. With that, Madam Chair, I have David Ahrens from the American Cancer Society who can share some information.
Before we do that, Senator Dibble, I just have a question. I know we were all eager and got the FMAP money in the stimulus package forecasted. Is the $40 million in lost tobacco fee, is that also in the forecast, do you know? Or is that waiting to happen to us yet?
I'm not certain about that. I
don't care if you
know.
No.
Nobody knows. Well, is there someone from finance here who might know? Gosh, I didn't think we did anything in here without them watching us. Huh. Well, does anyone from the Department of Human Services know the money's supposed to go through their little treasure chest before it gets into the general fund? Nobody knows if we have counted for this loss of money. Okay. Well, Senator Dibble, when you find out, would you let me know?
I will let you know. I'll make it my business.
I always like to know if there's rocks that are going to fall on us. Better to expect them than not to.
So, Madam Chair, members, I have David Ahrens from the Cancer Society and Rachel Callanan from the Heart Association who can share a few more thoughts with you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will be very brief. My name is David Ahrens, Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society. I think I speak for the Heart Association and that we very much appreciate the time of this committee this late in the session to hear this bill. This bill, we believe, is very consistent with this committee's efforts to reform health care in our state that worked last year. This is a bill that would make sure Minnesotans have access to health care, including preventive care, contain health care costs, and address health disparities facing Minnesotans of all geographies, incomes, and ethnicities. One out of every two Minnesotans will face potentially serious cancer in their lifetime, one out of every two. And this Act for a Healthy Future, Senator Dibble's bill, will aggressively attack cancer in our state. It would use a significant resource in tobacco taxes as a proven tool to reduce the number of people who smoke or reduce their consumption. Tobacco is responsible for 30% of cancer deaths, 90% of lung cancers are caused by smoking, and about 2,300 Minnesotans die each year due to lung cancer, and it's the leading cause of cancer death among men and women. This bill would ensure that some Minnesotans do not lose health care by providing funding for the Health Care Access Fund. The Cancer Society believes that the lack of access to health care is just about as important to avoiding cancer as it is to stop smoking. So access to health care and preventing smoking are the two biggest ways we can prevent cancer in this state. This bill goes after cancer risk factors, including obesity and youth tobacco, through the SHIP program. The SHIP program, it's my understanding, needs a new funding source at the end of a couple years, as required by the health care reform bill. This bill would provide that funding source through tobacco tax revenue. This bill would also, it relates to Senator Sharon's colorectal cancer a screening bill, in that it provides just an expanded amount of money that would be provided through a tobacco tax revenue. It is separate and different from Senator Sharon's bill, but it would provide even more dollars for more units of colon cancer treatment, which each unit of colon cancer treatment can save between $16,000 to $200,000 in colon cancer treatment costs by catching colon cancer early. This bill is aggressive, and we believe it is evidence-based way. It's a public policy package to prevent cancer and heart disease. We thank you for considering its pieces as well as it in total as a bill to try to aggressively contain the soaring health care costs in our state. We very much thank the committee for its time consideration.
Are there questions? Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Dibble, how much does this raise the cigarette tax per pack?
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, it's a dollar per pack.
Madam Chair, I would just say, I'm not a smoker, and I don't really particularly like smoking, but it is legal in this state, and I think that you're, at least the way it seems like we're going around here, you're gonna tax people to death before they die of smoking. So I am not going to be supporting this because I just think, if cigarettes are so bad, why don't we just eliminate them and say no more smoking? But then we would lose a lot of tax revenue, I would contend. But even though my good friend Senator Dibble is very eloquent in his testimony, I'm not going to support this because I am not supporting any tax increases whatsoever this year. And I want to also say that Mr. Ahrens does a great job, and I'm really proud of the job that he does. And I'm sorry I can't support this, but I just think that we're just taxing people to death. I don't agree with that.
Ms. Callahan, did you have some additional comments? Or?
Yes, Madam Chair. Good evening. My name is Rachel Callahan. I'm Senior Advocacy Director with the American Heart Association. And I just want to focus for a few moments on some of the health care savings that would result from this legislation. This bill really looks towards the future and needed investment now to save health care costs down the road. In this bill, we specifically target the key health care cost drivers in the state of Minnesota, including heart disease and stroke, cancer, tobacco use, and obesity. increasing the price of tobacco, as this bill proposes, will spur 20,000 adults in Minnesota to quit smoking. It will discourage 44,000 young people from ever picking up the habit. And that could translate into a savings of $960 million in health care savings. This bill also targets funding to programs that screen for and prevent the two deadliest diseases in Minnesota, heart disease and cancer. The heart disease and stroke prevention component to the bill could leverage some federal funding, as well as the colorectal cancer screening portion of the bill could also leverage some federal funding. The average cost of hospitalization for cardiovascular disease is $108,000. Just by preventing just over two people from being hospitalized by a heart attack or stroke, we would pay alone for that heart disease and stroke prevention component of the bill. Screening is key to prevention and early detection. The Women's Heart Health Promotion Program included in the bill would provide heart disease screenings for as many as 15,000 low-income, uninsured, or underinsured women. Failing to detect and treat risk factors early could be very costly for these women. The Office on the Economic Status of Women estimates that without prevention efforts, it's likely that costs of treatment for heart disease in this population alone, so just this 15,000 women, could total $405 million. Again, the colorectal cancer screening program, also funded in this bill, targets low-income, uninsured, and underinsured people. Focusing even further upstream, this bill would establish a permanent funding source for the statewide health improvement program. And in some research done for the governor's health care transformation task force, it was projected that fully funding this program, the SHIP program, would result in a 3% reduction in long-term health care costs by 2011. So significant reductions there. All told, this bill could save over $2 billion in health care costs through reduced smoking and effective prevention efforts. I appreciate the committee's time tonight on this bill, and I will stand for questions. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dibble. And it was interesting over the weekend when I was looking at the MSN webpage, they had this little statewide comparison thing. You could click on your state to see how much you paid in taxes for different things. And I was really surprised to see that Minnesota actually was lower than our surrounding states on a lot of the so-called sin taxes that, you know, that we typically think about, although I have to admit that Wisconsin was really low on the alcohol tax, just like North Carolina was, you know, kind of way down there on the tobacco tax. But other than that, and then it also said that a lot of states are proposing increases to deal with the deficits that they're facing this year. But I would be concerned if we got out of line with, you know, kind of the rest of the country to the point where people might be going even elsewhere. I mean, then we kind of defeat the purpose if people are buying their cigarettes from other places online or across the border or whatever. I mean, do you know where that would leave us as far as comparatively?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we would be higher than where we are now. We would move up to right now Minnesota is the 18th state, and we would move up into the top 10 if we raise the tobacco tax by a dollar. Wisconsin right now is considering a 75-cent tobacco tax increase itself, and that was after an increase last year. So Wisconsin and Minnesota are kind of moving up at the same, are considering proposing to move up about the same rate. So we would not be out of line with Wisconsin. Iowa is right in the mix. Iowa is 20th. Minnesota right now is 18th. Wisconsin is 15th. And so if Wisconsin and Minnesota moved up, we would be generally on parity with them. Of course, North Dakota is the one state where the taxation is far lower. But most of our surrounding states would be on parity with Minnesota.
Madam Chair, can I just say
Senator
something?
Corey.
I would just point out the fact that that North Dakota has a surplus, and they are a very low tax state. So
they have oil,
point
too.
That out.
Well, natural gas.
It'd be nice.
It would be nice.
Have oil.
Start drilling.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Dibble, I actually kind of looked at tobacco tax actually to give it to long-term care issues. But I do like the fact that you are targeting the SHIP program. I think that's really important. But I do believe a dollar is very aggressive. Yes, we are the lowest for our cigarettes in the surrounding area. So when I looked into it, I think by increasing it to what the surrounding states are doing, it would have generated about $25 million, I believe. And that seems reasonable. I mean, it would be very tough to go ahead and say a dollar, hoping that the other states come on board and pass 75 cents or whatever. I live 8 miles from the Iowa border, and they're just going to flock to some other state or get them online, as Senator Olson says. So I appreciate you looking into this. It looks like we're taking on a lot here. I understand the importance of leveraging the federal funding dollars too, but I'm having a little problem with the $65 million for the Health Care Access Fund to restore eligibility to 28,000 people. I would rather see us earmark some of these really important. I'm not that's not important, but make sure that we address either long-term care issues or the SHIP program or tobacco prevention, all that type of thing. So,
any other?
I wish it was a different figure, Senator Dibble.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Madam Chair, was that my fiscal note that just came around?
Yeah, it's a preliminary, but.
Okay.
Since
copy.
We
I haven't seen
had,
that yet. So
yeah, well, we're just looking at it
so
for the first
we've
time.
Been,
ourselves.
We've been hounding for that, and glad to see it's appeared. So, I just wanted to say thank you to Senator Rosen. I appreciate her perspective, and you know, I, you know, the dollar is aggressive. I agree completely. We know that, you know, that has the effect of bringing down, you know, in and of itself, it has a health benefit. You know, that's worth considering in terms of reducing the number of kids who start. If we can stop kids from smoking, then they're not going to become adult smokers, and they're that much more ahead. We've been pretty successful. We're down to 17% from 19%. You know, that's taken a lot of effort to get down to 17% if we can continue to bring those numbers down a little bit. And then, you know, just as I contemplate, Madam Chair and members, you know, the numbers of people we're considering eliminating from access to health care, you know, 113,000 by some estimate. If we can get 28,000 back through this mechanism, I'm that much not happy, but that much happier. And, of course, the funding the SHIP, which has a tobacco prevention, obesity prevention efforts to it, the rectal screening, say $400 million in our healthcare costs if we just put a little bit towards that, and the women's heart health, tremendous benefits. So that's how we came up with that number. But we can talk about it.
So, Senator Dibble, you know, the things that you're funding here, I realize that the SHIP is got some initial startup funds from the Healthcare Access Fund, but was never anticipated, nor is it practical in terms of that program to be a continuing source of funding. And these other things are traditionally not things that we funded out of the Healthcare Access Fund before either. So I'm just wondering if it might not be better to create sort of a separate fund and fund these things out of that fund and then transfer whatever you want to from this money into the Healthcare Access Fund, just, you know, to kind of try and keep those lines nice and clean and not get everything kind of blurry and messed up for future legislatures that maybe don't remember how we're doing this.
Madam Chair, I don't think that's how we actually do it.
No, you don't, but I'm asking if you would object to that. I think I would prefer to do it that way because, you know, in the future, people might forget and start saying, well, you know, we did fund this, you know, heart program for women out of the Healthcare Access Fund, so, you know, what's the matter with funding avian flu or whatever the deal is at the moment in the future, so... We just haven't traditionally funded these things. They've been funded, funded them out of the Healthcare Access Fund. We funded them out of the general fund. And they're, you could keep everything you've got in the bill without having all this money dedicated to the Healthcare Access Fund. Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, if that were to happen, would it just be a question of how the numbers were entered in the books? Or would it require any kind of additional administration to oversee that if you handled it separately like that?
No, it's just the way it would be tracked in the budget. So why don't we work on that for a minute here?
Senator Berglund?
Yes, Senator Sharon?
In another bill that we did not hear, which was directed at trying to recapture the tobacco money that was originally intended to be used for health care purposes. We didn't hear this, but it's a bill that I was pursuing that would have also provided a permanent source of funding for the SHIP program. In the language in that bill is reference to just what Senator Berglund is talking about, is establishing a very separate kind of funding account to which the money is dedicated, and then it's for a very specific purpose related to health promotion. And if you'd like to look at that language to see if that might be useful to adapt into this, I'd be happy to show that to you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I'm completely open to that. That sounds like a good idea. We do direct some of these dollars into the Healthcare Access Fund,
right,
about $65 million for those purposes specifically.
Those could be appropriated to that fund if that's what you choose to do. But we don't have to put it all in there and then fund everything out of it. It could be
protected. Right.
Okay, so what we need to do is just lay this over temporarily while Ms. Kavanaugh works on that for you. And we'll be coming right back to you. Senator Marty, Senate File 1235. Welcome.
Madam Chair, Senate File 1235 is a bill on addressing youth violence, trying to treat it as a public health issue that we can prevent rather than wait till after it occurs, and we have to deal with the outcomes of that. This came from some successful efforts in the city of Minneapolis, some initiatives that were targeting several neighborhoods in Minneapolis that had high youth violence rates. And this is an attempt to begin to move to expand and replicate that around the state and evaluate, see what works best. But they've had significant reductions in youth violence in the last several years. Some of that may be trends, but some of it may be because they've been doing aggressive efforts, including these community-based programs, which work with local schools and community groups and nonprofits and faith community and so on, bringing everyone together to try and do an aggressive effort to prevent this. And the bill, as you can see, is a short bill. It simply spells out what these violence prevention programs for at-risk youth are, what they are to accomplish in the first page you can see, and the second page spells out some of the aspects of what the programs would involve. And the state's role in this with the amendment will be contingent upon available funding. What we'd like to have is the Commissioner of Health and other commissioners, public safety, human services, education, I think, to identify several programs around the state that would meet this kind of criteria and then provide technical support, assistance in getting federal funds and nonprofit support, and evaluate them. And again, with the amendment, it will be one that would be the department's work would be based on its ability to find funding to enable them to do this. Again, we were envisioning their role as fairly limited in the first place, and obviously because of the budget will be more limited by this, but have Melissa Reed here from the city of Minneapolis to speak briefly to the bill.
Well, since we are passing out the amendment, maybe we should deal with the amendment first. Senator Prettner-Solon will move adoption of the A2 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Ms. Reed?
Madam Chair and committee members, as Senator Marty laid out, in 2003 to 2006, the city of Minneapolis saw a tremendous surge in violence across the city, but that was primarily driven by an epidemic of youth violence. We found that about 50% of the violent crime in the city was youth-driven. So we, at that time, really decided to take a really concerted effort and a look at youth violence and address it not only as a public safety issue, but as a preventable public health issue that can be prevented using clear, proven public health interventions and methodologies. So at that time, the City Council and the Mayor convened the Blueprint for Action, which set out to convene a task force and determine what specific intervention strategies would be appropriate for the city to attack the problem of youth violence. And what the task force identified were four core objectives that you see presented in the fact sheet in front of you, which are connecting every youth to a trusted adult, intervening at the first sign that youth are at risk for violence, restoring youth who have gone down the wrong path, and unlearning the culture of violence in our community. And taking those as our four guiding principles, the task force identified methodologies such as mentoring programs, family drop-in centers, truancy centers, increased community policing presence in junior highs and high schools, those types of community intervention programs to tackle the problem of youth violence. And what we did was identify four targeted areas in the city to use as our areas for the treatment to see if that differed from other areas of the city. During that time, the entire city did see a decrease in youth violence and in violence in general, but what we saw in those four treated areas was an over 40% reduction in juvenile crime. And that trend has continued since we implemented the program up through today, with every year an additional decrease in youth-related crime over time. The model that we have created in the city has really become a national model with both the federal government and other other cities throughout the country looking at the Blueprint for Action and implementing it in their communities. And what we are presenting to the committee today is to take the model that we have implemented in Minneapolis and to take that statewide, with the Department of Health being the convening and coordinating entity. Recognizing, of course, the limited funds that are available in this year and in the next year, what we have asked and Senator Marty offered in our amendment is that the coordinating efforts of this program are contingent upon the department successfully applying for and receiving funding to support this program. We know that through the federal stimulus, for one example of where this funding could come through, the Department of Public Safety has $5.5 million of competitive RFP grants that are available to other state departments. So that is one area, as an example, that the Department of Health could apply to the Department of Public Safety to fund this program. Also in the amendment, we suggested other state resources, federal resources, and private resources that could support any staff time that the department would need to support this effort. And we, as the City of Minneapolis, would be participating also with this, providing technical support, information about what our experiences have been, and asking the department to support five other cities across the state, as we had five neighborhoods in Minneapolis, to tackle the problem of youth violence and use proven, preventable methodologies, public health methodologies, to do so.
Are there any questions for Ms. Reed? If not, I have a question for the Department of Health. Very simple question.
Madam Chair, I'm Craig Akin, CFO at Health. With me is Mary Manning, Director of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease.
So very simple question is, when we're done with this session, do you believe you'll have the staff to apply for this money without requesting more appropriations for your staff?
Madam Chair, your question is, will we be able to, will we have the resources to apply for?
Well, this is going to take some staff to apply for these funds. Everybody just assumes the departments will do whatever we tell them to, but, you know, I think we're getting close to the point where we can't assume that always.
Madam Chair, right now we believe that we would be able to apply for some funds. Right now, the staff is entirely funded by federal dollars or other fee-related programs, so it would depend on whether or not those programs experience reductions also. And at this time, we're not certain.
Well, it would be at the federal level then, and we
yes.
have no control over that. Okay. Any other questions?
There are no state dollars in that injury area.
Okay, if there are no other questions, then Senator Prettner-Solon, do you want to move the bill as amended?
Madam Chair, just a curiosity, because Ms. Manning said that right now the staff are funded entirely by federal funds.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because the stimulus dollars are being used? Or
no, this was a federal grant that they applied for and received.
For this specifically?
On behalf of okay. Minneapolis. So.
Okay. Okay, yes, Madam Chair, I'd move the bill.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, it says here three for outstate, one for St. Paul, one for Minneapolis. Is this a competitive application process? How did they go through this?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we're certainly open to how the number, it was somewhat arbitrary just trying to find out. We wanted a sampling of these around the state. I'm certainly open, I think, City of Minneapolis has been working on it, and there are some communities that have been trying to do things like this. So I think it's the health department would be the one that would be identifying the ones they'd be choosing to work with. So I presume some sort of competitive thing. Again, it all depends on if federal money is there for them to have the ability to help apply and provide the technical support. And so,
and Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Senator Marty, you know, I love
these youth at-risk programs, because I definitely think they're needed. And I just read over the bill, and it's just a little vague, though. And it's very hard for me to get my hands around how you measure line 1.22, work to strengthen families. I mean, what does that mean? and how do you measure that? On the second page, you know, the job placement and support. I'm having a little tough time figuring out how you do this, who's in charge of making this collaboration and with the other programs that are already in the community, and who is the lead guy on this?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, let me just suggest that in the city of Minneapolis, the city took the lead. They had this task force, this blueprint. They worked with the city, pulled together law enforcement, the school district, nonprofits, the community groups, and so on. They pulled them together, and how does the health department or whomever evaluates? I mean, that's one of the things. Evaluation does cost money. Mm-hmm. And so, again, if there is no money, that's not going to happen. But I think the goal is to figure out which of the aspects of the program are most helpful. And I think you're not going to find any one thing. Boy, it was the chemical dependency treatment. I'm sure that's a big part of it. But it's the mentoring. It's the finding supportive adults to be involved. It's keeping kids active after school. It's a whole range of things. And one of the things you're going to be doing in terms of evaluating it is find out, do they have all these aspects of the program, and are they having notable decreases in youth violence?
Okay.
But, again, it is vague. I'll agree with you on that.
Okay.
Any other questions? If not, then we'll vote on Senator Pretner Solon's motion that Senate File 1235 as amended be recommended to pass. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Are we ready for Senator Dibble? No. Then let's go to Senator Ortman, Senate File 1709. Is Senator Ortman here?
Recommended to pass. Yeah, it has to go to finance.
Okay, then we are skipping and not taking up Senate File 1229 tonight. We're going to save it for a future hearing where there will be additional amendments to it, I believe.
Madam Chair, I'm just waiting for a fiscal note on it. And the department is back at the department right now. Completing that fiscal note.
Right, but I understand that some of the work that's been done on the governor's PCA program would need to be amended to this, and then this would need to be included in the omnibus bill. So we're not ready with those things either. So I think we'll take it up another day, hopefully not too far from now.
Okay.
Senator Erickson Ropes, are you ready?
Well, Madam Chair, I can update you on where we are in the bill. I believe we don't have a fiscal note yet, either. Ms. Kavanaugh worked out language today, and we have sent that off to the department, and we can kind of walk you through.
That's okay. Why don't we just come back to it when we have the fiscal note? Okay. Senator Lori.
Sure.
Senate File 1890.
I understand there's a fiscal note somewhere. I haven't seen it yet. It's not in our package.
Well, this was presented by the department earlier when we went over the stimulus package. So we will need a fiscal note because we need to
see
how many FTEs they think they need.
I think it does exist.
And
okay, and our testifiers are
and of
very
course
close.
This is a $4 million request, so we haven't found that money yet either. We know that.
Well, this is not really, Madam Chair and members, Senate File 1890 here, the health information technology incentives. This is really the policy around utilizing whatever money is there. It doesn't actually include the appropriation itself. So, I mean, we can leave it behind for the omnibus bill if you like, but this is really the language and the policy to make best use of whatever money we do appropriate. So it's a little different than than that. But if do you have the fiscal note? I'm told that it exists now. But I have yet to. Okay.
There's no cost.
Okay. There's no cost. I thought that there. I'd asked. I was told that there was a fiscal note. I'm sorry, by council. But maybe there isn't. There is no cost. This is the policy around best use of.
So why did it get referred to the finance committee?
I'm a little unclear as to that myself. This is really the policy language that would be wrapped around whatever investment is made. And we do have a historic investment and really strong effort in making sure that we move forward with health information technology investments and get providers moving as quickly as we can. And so we're actually in pretty good shape in being ready to take the greatest advantage of the federal opportunities. And this bill really is about putting that policy together to do that. So there is no fiscal implications for the language that's before us. I do have a small technical amendment, an A3 amendment that the Department of Human Services requested to just clean a couple of things up. There's nothing substantive in it, if members would allow me to move that.
All right, Senator Lurie, I'm just going to give you a little bit of advice, and you can take it or leave it. It's whatever. Doesn't matter to me, but there are a lot of bills that are getting jammed up in the Finance Committee that don't actually have a fiscal note in them because the author took whatever cost money out or, you know, a bill like yours somehow ended up here. You could make your amendment on the floor. You could make your technical amendment on the floor. Okay. Or we could do it here. If we do it here.
If we do it here, I got to go through the full Finance Committee.
That's right, because
I will withdraw my motion that we adopt the A3 amendment.
Can't get engrossed otherwise. And so
I withdraw my motion.
And then maybe you can work a deal out where you can pull the bill by rule to the floor.
I like that advice. So would you like us to spend more time describing the bill? Okay.
We're here to talk about fiscal notes.
That's what I thought.
If this isn't a fiscal issue, then we don't really need to discuss it. But you would want to make a motion, I think.
I would move that Senate File 1890 be recommended to pass and referred to the full Finance Committee, and I'll try to get it out of there through our rules.
Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, are we by any chance ready with Senator Dibble's bill? Okay, it looks like we are not, so I guess we'll move on. Here now? Boy, did you luck out.
In many ways, Madam Chair.
All right. So we will take Senate File 1709, Senator Ortman. This is a bill we've heard before, and we sent them off to work on their fiscal note. And and we have a fiscal note here. And we have a letter of opposition from the Minnesota Hospital Association that I hadn't seen previously. So anyway, so let's go back to the fiscal note, I would say. Now, did you have amendments to this bill when it was in this committee?
Madam Chair, we crafted one while we were outside the committee room with some of the suggestions of the members, and we incorporated it into the A5 amendment.
Okay, we have an A2 that was adopted, and then we have an A5, which is a delete everything. So the A2 is now incorporated into the A5 since the A5 is a delete everything. So, Senator Ortman, do you want to walk us through the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. The amendment makes two key changes that were worked out with some of the interested parties. The A2 amendment, or the A5 amendment, does two things. First of all, it allows the Board of Pharmacy to charge a small fee to providers to extend the costs for the pads and for the administrative costs onto the providers. Hopefully there will be an economy of scale when the Board of Pharmacy is buying these prescription pads that can be passed along to those providers. That fee now is estimated to be approximately 8 cents per prescription. That's an estimate. It's really unknown because it depends upon the contract and the RFP and all those things, a little bit more of the particulars. But estimated cost, approximately 8 cents. The range currently being paid by providers, including members of the Hospital Association, between 4 cents and 10 cents. So there might be a slight cost adjustment for them. If I could address that now, Madam Chair, I would say that to the extent that that's cost prohibitive, we've added the second piece to the A5, which grandfathers in the next 6 months. So if a provider is currently using a different type of pad, they can continue to use that pad for the next 6 months. So they won't realize that cost. And to the extent that it is cost prohibitive, again, that creates the incentive on the part of the providers to go quickly towards e-prescribing. With e-prescribing, there is an elimination of the pads. In many cases, it will never eliminate entirely the use of prescription pads, but that's another way to incent them to move to that system even more quickly. So those are the two big changes incorporated in the A5 amendment, Madam Chair, and I'm hoping that one of the members might offer that amendment.
And Senator Ortman, we really do need to fill in the blanks because that's what this committee does.
Well,
we can't appropriate an unknown amount of money.
Madam Chair, I think with the fiscal note, the actual fiscal cost is zero, and I don't believe that an appropriation is necessary, but I'm no expert in the preparation of fiscal notes, but I believe that's the case.
There is a zero cost to the health-related board's fund, but there is, there's two FTEs here. There's zero savings to the board, but there is cost to the board.
Madam Chair, I believe that the board representative is here, and hopefully he can address that question on behalf of the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. Here, basically, just to explain how the fiscal note on the A5 amendment was crafted and what it means. The most significant change in terms of the fiscal impact of this bill is that the Board of Pharmacy will now be able to charge a fee to the prescribers who purchase these. Essentially, the prescribers would be purchasing the pads from the board, and this language allows us to incorporate into the fee a slightly less than 1 cent charge to administer the program. It's about 2/3 of a cent added to the cost of the pads that would go to pay for those two FTEs and the initial startup costs that we have for computer system changes that we need to make, office configuration we need to do to handle two extra FTEs, and those sort of expenses.
And so you anticipate that this fee, whatever it is that you're going to charge, will raise how much money? Because we need to appropriate that money.
Right. The fiscal note does essentially explain that the expenditures for each of the years are as they are there.
So you want the $637 appropriated for 2010?
Correct.
And the $1.666
correct.
For with fiscal with year 2011?
That is correct, with the idea then being that we will recover those costs as we charge the prescribers the fee, the fees for purchasing the pads.
Okay, so does somebody want to move the A5 amendment with the blanks filled in? Senator Sharon will move the amendment. Is there any discussion?
It is another language change having to do with the special revenue account or fund.
Okay, and I guess Ms. Kavanaugh has another language change to make.
Madam Chair, on line, or page 2, line 4, after the period, insert the sentence, the fees collected shall be deposited into the state government special revenue fund, period.
Okay, so Senator Sharon incorporates that into the amendment. Any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, then those in favor of the A5 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Now, we do have this letter from the Hospital Association, and I think they're looking kind of agitated over there like they'd like to testify. So... Well, we have more than them, I guess. Welcome. Madam, identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Mark Skobic from Park Nicollet Health Services. primarily, our comments and concerns about this have more to do with the fact of the additional cost this will place upon healthcare systems. To comply with this legislation and to also handle the ongoing custody of the prescription pads that are being recommended here. I haven't had a chance to look totally at the amendment. However, our concern is that we currently have incurred tremendous costs to comply with the federal requirement under the Iraq funding bill that was passed a few years ago. It requires us all to have tamper-resistant prescribing practices in place. And organizations across the state have found different ways to be able to comply with it in the most efficient manner for the operations that they have, but also to take into consideration what the potential financial impact would be on the organizations to comply with it. Just to give you one example, one way that an organization can meet this requirement is to have a computer printed prescription that has criteria approved by CMS that meet the tamper-resistant standards. And as such, we have used those to comply with the federal law. Requiring us to go to a prescription pad process makes it much more complicated. It's going to require us to put new process flow changes in place, which is a very time-consuming and it's a very complicated task. But we also have concerns that moving more towards using handwritten prescription pads creates the opportunity, too, for the illegibility of the prescription that's handwritten and could potentially lead to adverse events, which we've been trying to avoid by using more electronic means. Okay. So those are particularly our concerns. We do currently use some because narcotics have to be prescribed with handwritten prescription pads. And the Drug Enforcement Administration's in the process of revising those rules now. So we're just a little bit concerned that this will add undue burden to hospitals in Minnesota, given that it doesn't really create any savings for the state.
And is there I mean, is there a way to exempt organizations that are already doing this from this legislation so that we'd only be talking about organizations that are not?
Well, one way I suspect you could do it is to exempt organizations that are compliant with the current federal requirements for tamper-resistant prescribing.
All right. Well, I guess it'd be good to know how many are left after that. It's worth doing this or not.
Madam Chair, one of the concerns that our physicians have, too, is if you just think about the processes that we would have to put in place, it wouldn't be practical for us to put prescription pads under lock and key and then take it out every time you use it. And unfortunately, prescription pads do get stolen. We may not be immediately aware of it, which creates concerns about how we then would deal with the reporting requirements under the bill. And frankly, what I have heard from our physicians is that drug seekers will find a way. And trying to use the healthcare system to try to monitor a drug enforcement policy, especially in these economic times when hospitals and healthcare systems are struggling with the current economics that we're facing right now.
Any other questions? I guess not. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, Sarah Nosnaski with the Minnesota Medical Association. I have to echo a number of the comments Mr. Skubick made just related to the cost and the need for this bill. Quite frankly, we agree that drug diversion and prescription fraud is a serious issue and needs to be taken seriously as a result. We believe that over the past couple of years, the legislature, in collaboration with the Board of Medical Practice, the Board of Pharmacy, and the healthcare providers and their professional associations have really tackled some of these issues when they have been identified head on. A few years ago, the legislature passed and is implementing NASPR. Last year, we had an internet prescribing, a bill to curb internet prescribing, and I'm not familiar with whether that's had successes yet, but perhaps the Board of Pharmacy could weigh in with us there. As part of the healthcare reform legislation, Minnesota is also out front on e-prescribing. You've heard that. The e-prescribing deadline is in 2011. So we're talking about a solution here that would be approximately, 6 to 12 months long. The amendment says that if you've already got tamper-proof prescription pads, as I understand it, you wouldn't have to comply for the first 6 months. So then we're talking about adopting an entirely new process for that second 6 months of a year, while at the same time we are sending a very clear message to healthcare providers in the state that they need to be moving in the direction of electronic prescribing, and they are supposed to be investing their resources and dedicating their time to making that conversion. So in addition to the cost, switching the cost back onto providers, I'm not familiar personally with how much some of our providers are paying for their tamper-proof pads right now, but Senator Ortman mentioned between 4 cents and 10 cents, and the projection is that this vendor's cost may be around 8 cents. Well, for some of the clinics that are only paying 4 cents, we're talking about doubling their cost. And as Mr. Skubick said, in this environment when we have so many different things on the table related to reimbursement cuts and other benefit cuts, and we're trying our best to care for patients and make sure that their access to care isn't inhibited, this seems like one additional burden that is sending the wrong message.
Are there questions? If not, thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could respond.
Yes, Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, prescription drug abuse is a growing problem across our country, and the policy committee was concerned about it, as I am. I think that this is an important way to go. Getting our prescribers to a place where they're using one type of pad in all of their practices, whether they're patients or medical assistance patients or non-medical assistance patients, and moving to a pad that will do more to prevent fraud than the current tamper-resistant pads that are in use in Minnesota. The new pads that we're proposing would require the numbering on them so that if there is a lost pad, we can track the number, and then we can go back and find the source of the fraud. That's an element that's missing in the current tamper-resistant pads that are sometimes in use in the state of Minnesota. Currently, the DEA still requires all controlled substances to be prescribed on a written pad. That has not changed. There's no regulations coming out. We hope that there will be, but we haven't seen them yet. I think that the cost here, we're trying to minimize it. I think the economies of scale will help. We're only estimating the cost at 8 cents, and we're estimating very conservatively. But the goal here is really a worthy one. It's worthy to try and keep Minnesotans from what's happening in Florida, where drug overdoses for opiates has doubled in the last year. People are dying because they have access to these drugs. They can be sold at a prescription pharmacy for $1 to $2 per pill and 10 times that on the street. And so there is an incentive for the fraud in this system, and we can start to address that even better than we are now by adding this system in. There's no cost to our state. We've worked on that, and we are trying to minimize the cost to the providers. We are in the range of their current costs. That's why the six-month grandfathering period to allow them to use what they currently have hopefully will reduce the costs, and then we'll extend the savings on. So I think this is an important transition, members, that we can make, and we can make it on behalf of Minnesotans, and I hope you'll help me do that.
All right. So we have the amendment in front of us. Did we adopt the amendment?
Yes, we did. Yes.
We did. Okay. So then is there anyone who wants to make a motion for Senator Ortman? Senator Rosen.
I'd like to make the motion.
Make the motion mm-hmm. that Senate File 1709 as amended be recommended to pass. Those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Chair is in doubt. Will the ayes raise their hand? Will the nays raise their hand? I believe the motion is not adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
No, I haven't. No. Okay, I was working on it. I think. I mean.
Members, we're going to move ahead with number 10, I'm guessing, on our agenda, which is Senate File 2070, Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I have an A1 amendment for this bill.
Great. I think the A1 is being distributed, and while the A1 amendment is being distributed, it looks as if you've got a couple of testifiers with you this evening. I'd like to call Mr. Greenfield and Mr. Cummers up as well.
And the A1 amendment, while it's being distributed, I'll just explain. It deletes Section 1 of the bill because the Department of Health has informed us that we can't do that idea, and then the rest of the language is language that inadvertently got left out of the drafting of the original bill.
Any questions or discussion on the A1? Senator Berglund moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The A1 is adopted. Senator Berglund.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, this bill is a bill that has been worked on to try to generate some federal funding for Hennepin County Medical Center, and perhaps in some areas of this bill, other facilities. The idea is to leverage federal funding with local spending so that this would not have any fiscal impact on the state budget, but could help some facilities deal with the revenue losses that they inevitably will have this session. So I'd like to have my witnesses testify and be ready for questions.
Okay.
Mr. Greenfield, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lee Greenfield. I'm a senior policy advisor to Hennepin County.
in the Hennepin County Medical Center, a previous member of the state legislature, a previous lobbyist for Hennepin County and the medical center. The bill before you, and I'll kind of briefly indicate what it does, but is essentially an attempt to use additional federal money that is available to us that other states use that we have not previously used in Medicaid additions, supplementary Medicaid payments. The one that you're probably most familiar with is upper payment limits for inpatient Medicaid patients. And that, as you will recall, has to be generated by non-state public hospitals. And the two of them that are most significant are the Hennepin County Medical Center and Regents. And then the ones that generate the upper payment room and using certified public expenditures, if you want to go into that, we certainly can. What we're attempting here is to look at other additions that have been allowed in other states and ask them to be used here. One is an upper payment limit for outpatient services to Medicaid clients. And another is additional payments to physicians who are serving Medicaid clients above their current Medicaid payment. And finally, the last is to allow, and this is allowable, an HMO to provide additional payments for the Medicaid clients that they send to a particular hospital, pay a higher fee. In all those cases, the local payment can be done by intergovernmental transfers, the hospital government unit that serves that hospital. And the federal money can be gotten for that, just as it is in upper payment limits. There also is additional money coming in DISH, the money for people who are either underpaid in Medicaid for underpaid Medicaid to hospitals, and who payment for people without who are poor and without health insurance. And the federal legislation this year provided 2.5% addition to whatever the total DISH payment that the state is getting. I won't go into the history of that, but anyhow. And what this is an attempt to leave what was in the old program under the rules that are in statute now, but to allow the 2.5% to be divided by the highest safety net providers in our state, those who in the last full data, which we have, I believe, which is 2002, but anyhow, will provide more than 25% of their income through the Medicaid, from the Medicaid program. And there are 9 of them in the state, and get a proportion to how much their volume, dollar volume is of the 9 of the what is 1.8 million the first year, and then doubles because it's an add-on to it, plus the 2.5% of that, so it's a little under 3.7 the second year. That would be divided by them. All, by the way, following federal legislation, all the intergovernmental transfers, the certified public expenditures that would be used would be voluntary because any addition to a local demand, local government, or public hospital that is made to get local match for federal money has to be voluntary by federal law if it's a greater share of that money. And however, obviously, that is not a roadblock. Let's see, I'm just trying to see if we have, those are the 3, Matt's notes, seem to have made it up. Anyhow, that is the concept. The concept is we would draw down the federal money and it would be available to, as CMS prefers and states very clearly, the hospital that generates it.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I just have a question for Mr. Greenfield, and that is, can we make the one we're doing already voluntary?
Senator.
Yes, Senator Berglund, no comment.
Senator Prettner Solon.
This is a little several million dollar problem we're trying to solve.
Senator Prettner Solon.
So, Mr. Greenfield, how much money would this generate?
Madam Chair, Senator Solon, we think that the outpatient provision would generate for HCMC between $2 and $4 million. The payments for HMOs, in our case, we'd be using MHP, Metropolitan Health Plan, and Hennepin Faculty Associates getting an increase in pay might generate $1 or $2 million each.
And for Regents?
Regents generally in our numbers runs about half of what we do in that kind of volume, though they're not sure if they can do the adjustment either through the HMO or the fees in their system. They have to work that out. We've started working it out. I'm not sure we're going to get both of those up in the first year that it would be in place, but we hope we can.
And Senator,
we have to work out all kinds of.
Senator Prettner Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Greenfield, you mentioned also that there, and I wasn't sure if you were referring to the old formula or if you were referring to an addition in this formula that would provide for about 9 safety net hospitals.
That
Mr. Greenfield.
Dish money, excuse me, Madam Chair, Senator Prettner Solon, sorry, old House members have bad habits. That is in the dish money we currently get. We have by formula distributed. We distribute that if we get it. Plus, it was taken away in an allotment last year. And last 2 quarters, every quarter, about 60-some-odd hospitals in the state get some money. That all stays in place, doesn't change. This is just the additional money that would come in for the, and we would help gather that just as we do with hopefully Regions and HCMC doing certified public expenditures.
Senator Prettner Solon.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Greenleaf, Greenfield, you mentioned also that your HMO, and can any HMO apply for this match, or is it just because HCMC owns the HMO that...
It
you
works because yes. HCMC owns the HMO and already subsidizes Medicaid clients in those. So it's a matter of rearranging that subsidy to take advantage of some federal money so we can have a greater subsidy.
Okay.
So, Senator Prettner Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Greenfield, and when you say that they voluntarily contribute, but really it's a paper transaction that is less than 24 hours, correct?
Mr. Greenfield.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner Solon, sometimes it'll be more than that. It's not like what you used to be able to do in the old days. It actually has to appear and track with the payments to the physicians and come back in arrangement. And part of the deal is making arrangements so that money that we're already giving without match for those things can be used in Garner match, and so we can add it on to what we're doing since the hospital is losing money at a fairly good rate.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner Solon.
Traditionally, these funds have been used for the benefit of all those who provide services for MA. Now, I can certainly appreciate that if I had an opportunity for my hospital, I would do the same thing if I could. At the same time, every single hospital in this state is hurting right now, and most of them provide significant MA services to their consumers or their patients. So it makes it very, very difficult then to say, well, because now we know you're hurting and Regions is hurting, that that you should benefit and the other hospitals shouldn't benefit, when in the past we've tried to spread that pain a little bit rather than place it just on some of the hospitals.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solin, you know, the last time we did this, Hennepin County provided the float for all the hospitals in the state. But we can't do that under federal law anymore. Any additional intergovernmental transfers by federal law have to benefit the organization making the intergovernmental transfer.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Senator Berglund, when was that language changed?
Mr. Greenfield.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solin. The language wasn't exactly changed. It is something that the CMS has been enforcing much and much more. We got around that when we did the certified public expenditures for the DISH money, because the federal government's interpretation of a certified public expenditures, they're paying the federal share for something they that has already been paid for that they agree fits DISH. That is, it is either an underpayment of Medicaid for a client, or it is a poor person who has no health insurance, and that they're available to be paid for by DISH. So once you pay them the certified public expenditures made, the feds give you the federal share. As far as they're concerned, they were just reimbursing you for money that was already expended appropriately. And they don't care what you do with the money at that point. We've agreed we put it into a pool and then distribute it. If you do an intergovernmental transfer, however, they want to see where it goes, and they want to see it in very short order. One of the things they absolutely get upset about is if it goes into some general pool like the state general fund. Now, I would be willing to testify any place, anywhere, anything we've done in this state, the money has stayed within health care other than the governor taking the provider tax. But that's a different story. But in intergovernmental transfers, those have stayed in health care. But they are not very happy about that.
And it hasn't in every state.
And they don't agree to necessarily let a plan go through that does those things. That's principally why, and also why we are, since the ones they've already accepted, certified public expenditure, that argument works. We can do it that way, and we're not touching that.
At this time, I'd like to call Matt Cummers to join Senator Berglund at the table. Mr. Cummers, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Matt Cummers, Hennepin County Medical Center.
Mr. Cummers.
Madam Chair, I wanted to fill in a couple of the details for you about this bill. At Senator Berglund's request, we work closely with national advisors to develop these creative ideas for bringing more federal health care dollars to Minnesota. It is clear that Minnesota has not as yet optimized federal drawdown dollars in health care, and other states have been much more proactive in drawing down and developing mechanisms to optimally leverage health care expenditures. These ideas leverage such things as upper payment limits to draw down more dollars into Minnesota to finance health care here. I wanted to comment, I know that there's been some discussion, so some of this, of course, is clear to everyone. However, just to comment on the temporary rate increase for qualifying hospitals under Section 2, Subdivision 28, that draws down the extra 2.5% in federal Medicaid disproportionate share money available through the ERA. And under the provision, this money will be distributed to those Minnesota hospitals with a percentage of inpatient Medicaid days that exceeds 25%. And I know that you were just discussing this. Currently, the DHS state register identifies 9 hospitals in the state that would benefit from this. The voluntary intergovernmental transfers really has 3 different parts to it, and I'll keep this very brief, but the first point A, mandates that the commissioner determine a fee-for-service outpatient hospital services upper payment limit for non-state government hospitals. This upper payment limit will be communicated and voluntary intergovernmental transfers will then be made to the state in corresponding amounts. This will allow a maximization of medical assistance payments to non-state governmental hospitals in this category for outpatient services. The intergovernmental transfers are voluntary payments, since any requirement for greater local participation and drawing down matching dollars would jeopardize the state's ability to access enhanced health care dollars under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. In other words, we cannot compel a larger local share and still maintain our ability to pull down the ERA dollars. Point B creates a very similar provision that exploits the upper payment limit for physicians working at Hennepin County Medical Center and Regents Hospital. Utilization of the upper payment limit for physicians is something that has been achieved with success in other states, but has never been implemented in the state of Minnesota. Finally, just to comment on point C, this utilizes a similar construction that seeks to maximize payments for managed care services made through MHP or Metropolitan Health Plan and health partners to HCMC and Regents Hospitals. This provision cannot be quantified on our behalf without further discussion with the Department of DHS and Metropolitan Health Plan. I hope that some of these background comments have been helpful in clarifying some of the issues for the committee.
Thank you. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Commerce, you said that we haven't been very successful or very effective, or we haven't really maximized our attempts to get these federal dollars. Are there other things that we could do? Are there other hospitals or other health plans that could apply for similar dollars, or is there any way to maximize more of this so that other hospitals could benefit also?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I think it'd be helpful to know what the nine are.
I know what they are, Madam.
Benefiting.
Mr. Commerce or Mr. Greenfield or someone.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I can list all nine.
They are Children's Healthcare in Minneapolis, Children's Hospital and Clinic in St. Paul, Gillette Children's Hospital, Hennepin County Medical Center, Cambridge Medical Center, New Ulm Medical Center, University of Minnesota Medical Center, Miller Dwan Medical Center, and Regents Hospital.
Any additional questions from the committee? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Yes. Madam Chair, my question is, are there ways of maximizing further so that we could take more benefit of these federal dollars?
Madam Chair, Senator Solon, thank you for your question. In some sense, I haven't been around long enough to make an authoritative statement about Minnesota's ability to pull down federal dollars, but Lee told me so and provided the historical background on that comment. Our team has worked together fairly extensively over the past 6 to 8 weeks to develop these ideas. We've done a fairly broad review of the federal law relating to especially to public hospitals and larger hospitals. Unfortunately, due to resource constraints, we haven't been able to look at every idea that could relate to Minnesota hospitals, so there certainly could be ideas out there.
It isn't like we're holding anything back.
No.
I mean,
the first part of the bill does, of course, bring the largest amount of money in terms of the HIT payments, and I realize that there may be an amendment to remove that from this bill. However, that was one that does apply to every hospital in the state.
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Berglund.
That was removed because the Department of Health told us that we couldn't do that section. That doesn't mean that the hospitals and clinics are not going to be eligible for HIT money out of the stimulus bill. We just can't do it the way it was done in this bill. And Senator Lori's bill, I think, does accomplish that.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, again about the 25%, I'm just not certain if that's a redistribution of the same funds that we've had in the past to now just nine hospitals. We used to spread it further, or if it's additional dollars that we're spreading between these nine hospitals.
Mr. Commerce.
Madam Chair, Senator Solon, I can comment very clearly that this relates to exclusively to new money that is coming in under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The ERA, so-called ERA, stipulates that DSH payments to Minnesota or disproportionate share payments can be increased by 2.5% in the first year and 5% in the second year, which will draw, right now Minnesota draws down about $70 million in DISH payments total. So the increase would be approximately $2 million or $1.8 million in the first year to the whole state. And in year two, because the ERA match doubles, we would bring in about $3.6 million as a state as a whole. This is totally independent from previous and pre-existing DISH payments, but it is an additional $5.4 million over 2 years.
Senator Prentice-Sullen, I'm appreciative of your line of questioning that, you know, how is it that we could expand this or do this more broadly? But I do think that there are a number of situations where we're not able to reach as broadly as we want to in any particular given area, but at the same token, it's good and important to move forward on those things that we do have jurisdiction over or that we can impact some change in. And maybe this will be an impetus for some other organizations and the Minnesota Hospital Association and others to look and continue to work on creative and innovative ways to further strengthen those federal dollars. Any additional questions or comments from the committee? Senator Prentice-Sullen.
Madam Chair, I'm passionate about hospitals.
We feel that. Senator Prentice-Sullen.
Anything for hospitals. I'm very, very concerned about how they're affected in Greater Minnesota also. And I don't want to take anything away from HCMC or Regions, but this is a very, very difficult thing. I mean, these are some of the biggest employers in our area.
That takes care of the appropriation.
Yeah. And they are hurting. And the governor's budget is devastating. And each of them has a different story to tell. Because some of them may have very high MA rates, but some of us have very high Medicare rates. Unbelievable high Medicare rates. Some of us are sitting on border states where we are also we also have high MA rates and Medicare rates from other states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Iowa or the North and South Dakota. Those aren't even counted in our formulas when we distribute our DISH dollars or our Merck funds or many of the funds. So there isn't always any equality. Plus, we get paid lower on our MA payments anyways in Greater Minnesota than is paid in the metro area. And so I'm just looking for some equality, some way that we can also keep our hospitals alive in Greater Minnesota.
If I may, let me just try to ask this question then. Is there something, Senator Berglund, that's contained in this bill that my sense is that it's not that any one particular organization is being excluded, that a hospital is being excluded, but rather, given the federal constraints, what is included in your bill is what's available. And so if I wanted to entertain an amendment tonight to incorporate St. Mary's Duluth or the institutions that I represent or many of them around the table into this bill, that's not possible. Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, I think the only way it would be possible would be for them to suddenly get some agreement with their county to begin making major contributions to their hospitals. And I just don't expect that's going to happen right now. And so, you know, where that is happening or where we can do that, then we're doing it. And then with these additional DISH dollars, we're picking up some more money. And, you know, I think most people consider New Ulm to be in the rural part of the state. And I think it's probably a surprise to most people that New Ulm has that high of a Medicaid population. But they do. So you know, we're trying to do what we can here with fairly limited amount of additional upper payment limit room and with intergovernmental transfers that could be made because institutions, counties are making expenditures on behalf of healthcare institutions.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Berglund. And just to echoing what Senator Prettner-Solon said, and I know this is a concern that we all share, and I'm sure it's a concern that you share as well, regardless of where, you know, we each may have a district in the state. But I just had lunch a couple of days ago with the hospital administrator in my district to emphasize yet again how devastating the governor's budget proposals would be and how threatened our health care facilities in rural Minnesota would be, especially where we have a Medicaid and high Medicaid and Medicare populations combined. And I just think that from an equality standpoint, rather than looking at individual funds, at some point we need to somehow take a look more broadly, knowing that we have limited funds available, and try to somehow equalize that disparity so that we don't end up closing some of the facilities or closing access to healthcare facilities in some parts of our state. I mean, it's really hard to ever take away from one in order to add to another. I mean, that whether it's in healthcare or education or anywhere, no one ever likes to do that because everyone is underfunded. But somehow we can't afford to lose access to health care in some geographic areas of our state. And I think that's the concern Senator Prettner-Solon is trying to express.
Well, Madam Chair, and Senator Olson, you know, we don't have a lot of flexibility. It's not like Medicaid federal funding comes in a block grant that we could just divvy it up however we want. It comes based on billings. And, you know, we can't change that. I mean, it isn't exactly like the school aid formula where we have a lot more control over various weighted factors that we build into it. This is a federal state program. We provide the state dollar, and the feds provide a federal dollar for certain services. And if you have more, you know, I guess the good news is if you have more Medicaid clients, you get federal funding, albeit however small we make it this year. I think there are other hospitals that are feeling like, you know, if they don't have quite so many Medicaid clients, maybe they're better off this year. So, you know, there's not much I can do to create an equalized Medicaid formula. It isn't allowed under the federal law.
Senator Berger.
So if there are no other questions, then I would move that Senate File 2070 be laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Move on to the next one.
Oh, we don't have to vote?
Senate File 460. MA payments for hospital acquired conditions. Senator Berglund.
I'm not sure if I have the current fiscal note on this bill, so maybe somebody could bring it to me.
Members, there is a fiscal note in your packet. And Senator Berglund, we also have the A5 amendment. Do you have a copy of that?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll move the A5 amendment.
Senator Berglund moves adoption of the A5 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And the opposed? The A5 is adopted. Senator Berglund.
So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, this bill will bring us into conformance with non-payment for hospital-acquired conditions and for certain treatments, bring us into compliance with Medicare in regard to that those items that Medicare doesn't pay for or is shortly soon expected not to pay for. And the department's fiscal note pretty much says, you know, that's all nice and we'll save a little money, but it's not enough to give you any number. And I just have to say one thing about this because, you know, I had a meeting today with folks from the Department of Human Services in regard to some work they're doing on long-term care for us to try to salvage some of our last $30 million out of the governor's budget because of the FMAP requirements. And they themselves said to me, we're having trouble with the part that is in managed care because we don't believe we can extrapolate from fee-for-service anymore savings on the managed care side because we don't have a large enough population in fee-for-service. And that is exactly what this fiscal note has done. It's extrapolated from fee-for-service, which, you know, whatever year it was they looked, they found two sponges were left in somebody, and maybe another year they probably would have found none. And they're extrapolating that to the managed care side. And I just have to say for the record that I don't feel like that's really doing us a very thorough job of trying to figure out what these savings would be.
Questions from members? Senator Berglund.
So, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 460 as amended be laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senator Lori.
I do have one question real quick, Madam Chair. Thank
Senator
you.
Senator Lori.
Senator Berglund. I'm wondering if this would also preclude, you know, if somebody has heart surgery and then they're in the hospital for a little while in recovery or and got an infection or something after the heart surgery, would the heart surgeon still be able to bill for the services they provided unrelated to the work later? I'm just trying to get a feeling for how
Senator Berglund.
Well, if they have to do the surgery over again, you know, they did a surgery and it caused an infection, they have to do that surgery over again because it didn't work for some reason because of the infection, then they couldn't bill for the second surgery.
Okay, but
Senator
they would
Lori.
Still be able to bill for the first, or if they fell or something and had other adverse events,
right.
The core surgery that was performed well would still be able to be.
Right, but if they fell and they needed a second surgery, then the second surgery wouldn't
okay.
be
okay. Okay, that helps clarify things a little.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, one of the things that I know from firsthand experience, or I guess because it happened to a family member, and I was told that this has become a rather frequent event, is people falling out of bed and breaking their hips in nursing homes because they're of the rules that were passed where you can't restrain people by having a bar on the side of the bed or that type of thing. And I'm just wondering how far would this be intended to go? I mean, if someone
well, it's exactly
Senator Berglund.
I mean, it's exactly what Medicare doesn't pay for today. And obviously, the department doesn't think it's very much, but generally speaking, hospitals are allowed to have bed railings. It's nursing homes that can't do permanent bed railings, and this bill doesn't apply to nursing homes. It's just
true.
For hospitals.
Senator Prettner-Solan.
Madam Chair, I have a question about the poor glycemic control, and I don't know what these ICD-9 codes are, but I'm assuming they are breakdown of the skin or something like that. And, you know, glycemic control isn't always in the control of the physician. It's often in the control of the patient, whether the patient is compliant or not. And I'm not sure what this would amount to. I mean, would this mean that a physician would refuse to see a patient if they had poor
this
glycemic
is
control?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solan, this is a condition that would develop while they're in the hospital. if they're being admitted for poor glycemic control, then the hospitalization would be fully paid for. But if the hospital has let their insulin, you know, administration not be proper, then it's the hospital's fault and the hospital wouldn't pay be paid for it.
But, Madam Chair.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
That isn't always the case for people with diabetes, because if they're brittle in the first place, they can be stable when they go in the hospital. And in the hospital, if they have some type of surgical procedure or some kind of medical crisis, they can get out of glycemic control. So I don't know that the physician certainly has to be on top of it monitoring it, but I'm not certain they can prevent it. And this is just then another expense to our hospitals on top of what the governor's already doing.
Well, it doesn't Senator look like Berglund. It's going to be much of one. I mean, you know, we haven't had any opposition to this bill as it's gone through the process at all. So, you know, at this point, I think it's probably just easier for everybody. I could consider it an administrative simplification to be doing something similar to the way Medicare is doing it.
Any further questions? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, this is just maybe a curiosity point, but I just wonder if it's determined that this was because of an adverse event and so the payment isn't made, is that information available to the patient then? I'm just wondering if it causes liability lawsuits like for malpractice, or if it's not admissible for that purpose, or if you've heard anything about that being an issue or anything?
Hasn't come up in any of the committees.
Better come back.
Senator Brooklyn, we did hear this bill in health policy.
Yeah, we did.
I would
move the Senate File 460 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
We will move on to Senate File 502, Veterans Home, Medicare, Federal Certification. Senator Berglund.
I have an A1 amendment.
You have an amendment. It's being distributed. The A1 amendment is being distributed and contains the specific appropriations. Any discussion on the A1 amendment?
And just
Senator Berglund.
Just to be clear, this is the bill that would move our veterans' nursing homes toward Medicare certification. And this amendment is not appropriating everything that was requested in the fiscal note. It is appropriating, as you see, $259,000 that would provide for one clerical reimbursement billing specialist and 3.5 full-time equivalent senior occupational therapists. And this would become part of the base level funding. And it appropriates $300,000 for billing systems and software and for training. And that's a one-time appropriation. We have this little spread, this mini spreadsheet to hand out that shows that this would be a cost in the first biennium. But then in the next biennium, there would be net savings.
Any discussion on the A1 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund on the bill.
If there are any questions, I would take them.
I would just comment that I think one of the positives about moving in this direction, as I understand it, is that we will be responsible or held to the federal requirements with regard to safety. And I think that that can only be a good thing and would be good news for members of this division. Any additional questions or comments? Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, I do note that we have quite a number of veterans in the audience today. So I'm just wondering if any of them want to speak, or I know there's some concerns that have been voiced about if we move to this, it's going to somehow affect the per diem. And I wonder if somebody could review that with us.
Senator Berglund, was this bill heard in policy?
Well, this bill's been heard a number.
In here. We heard testimony on this, as I recall, in this division on this issue. And I think we've even had discussions on this various times when the department has been here reporting.
This
as they often
simply
are.
Provides
Senator
additional
Berglund.
Federal revenue for our facilities. In addition to the additional federal revenue, it, as Senator Lynch said, gives us a little more peace of mind about the standards of care because all of our other nursing homes do meet Medicare certification in the state. And so it would be a good thing for our veterans' nursing homes also to meet that level of care.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I think I understand the upsides of it here, but I don't know that I was in the policy committee when we heard this bill. I'm not recalling it. I'm wondering what the downsides are for the vets, because I know they do have some concerns.
I don't think that we're not going to take testimony tonight on the policy behind this, but if someone from the department would like to come forward and speak to the fiscal merits of this, I think that
would
be
appropriate. While they do that, I can just add that there are quite a few other states that do have all of their veterans' homes Medicare certified.
Senator Lynch?
Senator Sharon.
Before the testimony, I just would like to ask a question so that if there's some testimony here. There are in the bill itself, there are dates established for coming into compliance, and that requires a number of phenomena to be developed within the system in order to receive this certification. And so my question would be whether or not we have evaluated whether or not the capacity is there to actually get that infrastructure in place in order to be successful in an application process for certification. I hope someone can speak to that.
Senator Sharon, I would just note that in the, and while I haven't read this word for word, under the assumptions on the fiscal note, I think in part the timeline is addressed. Senator Berglund, I don't know if you have anything to add to that or?
No, I think in talking with the Department of Veterans Affairs, I mean, they believe that they would be able to apply. But then there's a time period in which you have to be inspected. And so in the fiscal note, they're assuming it would be 6 months before there would be an inspection. And during the time that you're waiting to get inspected and certified, you're not getting the federal funds. So the dates are just sort of the starting point for, you know, sending in your application.
Okay. Welcome to the committee once again. And if you would just keep your comments brief and to the fiscal implications of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to address this issue. See how my comments are restricted strictly to the fiscal implications. I will say that there is an assumption that we are going to bring in federal dollars to the tune of I don't know what.
Before you continue, can I just ask you to clearly identify yourself for the record?
Gilbert Acevedo, Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Healthcare, Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs. It is true that there are other veterans' homes in the nation that are CMS certified, Centers of Medicare and Medicaid Services. The Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs in the past year merged with the veterans' homes. And for many years, the veterans' homes have not applied for certification. It feels like we are being held accountable and taken to task because the Veterans Home Board had not done this in the past. We are putting together a feasibility study to actually look to see whether it is or it is not feasible to become Medicare certified. We want to do as much as possible to bring federal dollars into the state of Minnesota. There was a bill that was put forth in this committee for Medicare Part D, and we looked at that and we felt that it would be feasible, and it is fiscally responsible to do. But at this present time, our finance department, they have not had the training to do Medicare billing. It takes a lot more than just billing, of course. You have to do all of the preparations for your survey preparation. Our nurses have to be able to document in accordance with the MDS standards and make sure that all of the assessments are done correctly in order for billing. So there is a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done prior to submitting certification. It would be irresponsible of the department to submit requests for certification when, in fact, we are not ready to certify. This committee is very much aware of all of the press and the negative press that the veterans' homes, in particular Minneapolis, had over the past few years. If we apply for certification and start to fail because we're not ready, that negative press will be there again, and we don't want that. There's a number of things that are going on with the veterans' homes at the same time. We have a number of construction. We're building a new Building 9. We're demolishing the old Building 9, building a new Building 9, renovating Silver Bay Veterans Home, and we're also adding an additional 21-bed special care unit at the Fergus Falls. So there's a lot of activity in the department at this present time, but at no time did the department say we were not going to look at this. We really do want to look at it. It is in the best interest of our veterans to see whether this is feasible or not feasible.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Assistant Commissioner, thank you very much. I just want to publicly thank you for the great job you've been doing out at the Veterans Homes. You took on quite a challenge, and we're not there 100% yet, but things are much improved, so thank you. And I don't recall talking about this bill in the Health Policy Committee. Now, we're in and out of committees for various appointments. Did you have an opportunity to testify on the policy side of this bill in Senator Marty's committee?
This is not
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Erickson Ropes, this would not be in the purview of Senator Marty's committee. It's not in his jurisdiction. This was sent to the Finance Committee because it is a financing mechanism.
Okay. So
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, so we haven't had a chance to discuss the policy parts of this bill then at all anywhere?
Well, we have
Senator
had,
Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Erickson Ropes, we have had it in front of the committee both since the bill has been drafted and introduced, and we've had the discussion about the possibility of doing this at other times when the department has testified in front of the committee.
And
I think it was Senator Lori that actually brought up this issue a couple of years ago about how we were missing out on this federal money and had suggested to the former Veterans Homes Board that they look into it.
If I may, Mr. Acevedo, one of the things, you know, I view this sort of as twofold. One, as I mentioned, I think there's some good things that could come of this with in regard to the safety compliance component, but also, and to the veterans that are in the audience tonight, we are seeking ways to bring additional resources and additional revenue into the system so that we can are best positioned to do this important work that needs to be done. And so if we can try to look at this in that light, I think that might be helpful. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Senator Berglund, in general, I understand what the goal is here, and I want to go back to the deadline dates. I just have to have a sense of whether or not, you know, we're by you putting deadlines in the legislation, we're communicating our strong interest in seeing this new effort be made so that we can capture more money for the veterans. But are you really married to those deadlines? Because I'm not certain that we want to set something up with a deadline that's not achievable, even though there's money appropriated, if the capacity building, the underlying capacity building, can't be accomplished by that time. That's one question that I have. This, and then I'd like to know from the deputy commissioner, since you're hearing from us, we think this is important to achieve, and not sometime way off in the future because there's lots of other things that we need to do. If you captured it as a priority like we'd like to see it be, what would be an appropriate timeline? What would be a better timeline for you? Then my second question is, the assumptions that are being made about what money would be captured if we were certified, are those assumptions correct based on your requirements for how you admit to the veterans system? Those are two questions. So I think, Senator Berglund, I'm asking you about the dates.
Let's start there. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, these dates were selected after discussion with Mr. Oliveira, and, you know, they said, you know, we originally said, well, you know, some of the smaller homes are more ready, so when do you think you could be ready to apply for certification for those? And we were told that it would be the fall of 2009, and then we said, and how long do you think it would take Minneapolis? And they said another year, so that's how we put it in the bill.
And the Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, if I may, just want a point of clarification. It was during a hearing that I was asked, in a perfect world, when would you or how would you see the homes being certified? I responded, in a perfect world where we would have the proper funding, the proper staffing, the proper training, I said, for the smaller homes, 6 months and a year for the larger homes, the one Minneapolis home. If I recall, the chair said, and we all know we don't live in a perfect world, but that was my response at the time. I did not say that the fall would be when we would certify the smaller homes and a year later would be the Minneapolis home. It was a response to a question that I viewed as a hypothetical situation in a perfect world. In response to Senator Sharon, Madam Chair, the timeline that I feel would be appropriate, one of the things that we put in the fiscal note is that we are going to be conducting a feasibility study. We're already doing that. The department is going to absorb the cost of that. We want to make sure we do this right. We don't want to spend taxpayer dollars to do something that's going to fail. So we want to make sure we do this right. We can have the response of that feasibility study by October of 2009. That is what we're looking at, our target date. At that point, what we're doing with this feasibility study, we're doing two things. We're doing, one, looking to see whether it's feasible to be Medicare certified in the state of Minnesota, and I'll speak to the reason why in a second. The second thing we're doing with the study is that we're conducting mock surveys. Part of a hearing that we were here, we were asked about mock surveys, whether we were continuing to do mock surveys, but that legislation expired. But we want to be proactive, and we want to do mock surveys because we want to provide the best care for our veterans. So we're going to do twofold. One is look at a feasibility study, see whether it's financially feasible to do this. Second thing is, while we do the mock surveys, we're going to conduct a high-level survey at each home and see what we need to do, at what point, what type of services we need to fix, what policies and procedures we need to put in place. And that's what our feasibility study is going to do. So the department's already moving forward with that. The question about our timeline and the finances that we would bring in, that we would capture. Under Minnesota law and our rules, our residents are applied to the home on a first-come, first-served basis, basically on the date of application. Most of them come from their home or from another nursing home. They don't come as a direct admit from a hospital where they would have a qualifying stay, a three-day stay, in essence, a 4 days in a hospital or a three-day stay, which would qualify them for Medicare coverage. So our numbers are very small when it comes to that. So most of the numbers that we're going to be looking at are those residents that are currently at our veterans' homes that would have a medical happening, such as a fall with a fracture, pneumonia possibly, and end up at the hospital with a qualifying stay. At that point, when they come back, we can start billing Medicare Part A. And that's where our rehab services, our nursing services, those types of things would be charged at that point. And the reimbursements would come in. We're also looking at Medicare Part B as an option per the legislation. Medicare Part B is looking at outpatient services, things such as rehab services that are not tied to a Part A stay. We don't have, in some of our facilities, we contract our services for for rehab. And those rehab services right now are showing very little, if any, reimbursements to Medicare Part B. And we provided that in the fiscal note. It speaks very clearly to that. I am not opposed. I will go on record as saying I'm not opposed to looking at this. It is possible. I came from a veterans home that I was the administrator that was Medicare certified. We were billing Medicare and Medicaid, and we did it very well. But I just want us to take a look at this and slow down. I don't see the urgency. I understand the financial implications of the state and the budget that we're in right now, but I think it would be far worse if we rush into something and then it'll be disastrous. That is my concern.
Any additional questions or comments from members? I would just say that I do think there is some urgency to this matter. I think that's why the bill has been brought before the division. Senator Berglund.
I guess, did everyone get their questions answered?
Senator Sharon.
I just am still uncertain that with this kind of an expenditure, even with this expenditure, which is a significant amount of money that we'll have to find from the general fund to accomplish this, if the dates are not, if we're setting up the dates in a way that simply is not achievable, not only because of a money issue, but because of these issues that you were talking about, Deputy, where you're trying to develop through your mock surveys, I think you said, where you're going to test your system. If I understand what you're saying, you're testing the system to see the gaps in the system that would have to be corrected in order to get Medicaid certified. And that will be exposed by October, you're saying. And then you develop. Then from that you would develop the interventions to correct those things so that you can become Medicaid certified. And I don't, if that's the case, if that just that initial process of determining what the gaps are in your system that have to be corrected to be Medicaid certified will take till October, how you can possibly achieve these deadlines. I don't know if that mock survey deadline is too far out there and we should encourage you to shorten that up. I don't know. I just am very concerned that we not spend a lot of money to establish an outcome that we can't achieve within the time frame. I like the goal. I like giving support to the system to accomplish it, but I don't know if the deadlines are reasonable. And that doesn't mean I don't think that this is important or priority. I just don't like us to be set up to not be successful.
I will just interject that we have had discussions with the department or the Veterans Home on the desire to move in this direction for there have been many, many opportunities in this division where we have had that communication and that dialogue department. But Senator Berglund?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, I think we're kind of at the point where if we can't get ready to do this by fiscal year 2011, then we really can't afford to do it at all. Because clearly, you know, the department is saying it's going to take some investment. You know, whether they do a study or not, they're saying it's going to take some investment because they don't know how to bill for it, and they need somebody who can, you know, at least one person who can bill for all the homes. They need to hire physical therapists instead of contracting that service, and they need some training for their staff to know how to do the record keeping so that the billing can take place. And I guess I'm saying, you know, we've been as generous as we can in this amendment with our investment to justify it in regard to the savings. So, you know, if we don't think we can do it, then we can't do it.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Deputy Commissioner, I don't know if this is a question for you or Senator Berglund, but I guess I'm just wondering, you know, if we didn't give you this appropriation, it sounds like this is a direction you were heading anyway and hoping to do. And so from a finance standpoint, I'm wondering, you know, are you perhaps better off at least getting this additional funding to help accomplish this task? Or how would you have handled this otherwise without this money? Would you have been asking for an appropriation? Or why... how were you going to pay for it, I guess, without this appropriation?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, as part of our 5-year strategic plan, that Medicare billing was part of that, and we're looking out into the future. And I've heard here tonight that there's been many discussions with the veterans' homes, but the people that responded or should be responding to that are no longer part of the veterans' home. What I am saying that here today, we have already taken steps. We're already doing training with our staff. We're trying to educate a lot of our employees as to how to do this. I think the piece that maybe I'm not articulating correctly or well enough here is that oftentimes there's a comparison to in the community, a community nursing home can just do this. We have employees that have been employed for 20 to 30 years at that veterans home. They have not kept up with CMS certifications and CMS changes because they've never had to. I'll give an example. We are not HIPAA certified at any of our veterans homes. We do not follow HIPAA standards. We are moving towards that. We are moving in a very quick pace to try to get that resolved. But that is the situation that has been confronted that we are dealing with at the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs at this present time. The Veterans Home Board knew that they did not have to become HIPAA certified, so they were not HIPAA certified. They knew that they didn't have to become CMS certified, so they didn't pursue CMS certification. We're doing that. We're looking at this. Now, to answer the question, how are we going to pay for this financially, we would probably have to come back and ask for additional funds. That is correct. But I think that putting a start date that is such a short fuse date when there is so much to do to become certified, I don't feel that would be appropriate.
Once again, Senator Sharon.
Oh, thank you. I just want to be clear that, and I'm not clear because I was just whispering with Senator Laurie over here. Does the legislation asks for the commissioner to apply for the certification, is that does that obligate you to be ready for a visit within a certain time frame, or does that give you time still to prepare for it? Because that's the only objection I'm talking about here is whether or not this date of October 1st, 2009, when your mock surveys are just going to give you the information you need for improvements in October. If just applying for the certification still allows you time to make up for or train all these people just on how to do HIPAA. I mean, it's unbelievable that that's not even in the system, but it is. And this is a new deputy commissioner who's trying to resolve these issues that we've been complaining about for a long time. So I'm interested to know, is this deadline one that you can work with. And if you apply for the certification, what does that mean in terms of when you are going to be visited to determine whether or not you meet the criteria?
Senator,
or are we setting you up to have a visit before you know clearly that you're going to get other criticisms about your system?
Senator Sharon, on the fiscal note, under the assumptions on the first page, about halfway down, it assumes that once the Veterans Home applies to become CMS certified, it may take up to 6 months for the survey to occur. Deputy Commissioner Acevedo, I don't know if you have anything more that you want to add or clarify to that, but that's covered in the fiscal note.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, at the time that we submit the application, there's an assumption that we are ready at that point. We don't control when CMS comes to the facility to start their survey. They don't call us and say, here we are, on this day we'll come and visit you. What will happen is that any time they can come in, and right now our research that we're checking, we've contacted the Department of Health, and they're saying that it may take up to 6 months. We don't know that. So taking that assumption that, you know, we were to submit the application and then they show up a week later, they can do that. That's out of our controls. Once we submit application for certification, we're certifying that we're ready for that visit and to be certified at that point.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members, you know, I think if you look at this little kind of revised spreadsheet that we have here, and if you just move all the columns over one in your mind, what you would see is that we would be making an investment of $399,000 in fiscal 12 in order to get a savings of $380,000 in fiscal 13. I can't justify that. So if the idea is we're going to study this for a while and come back and ask for money next year to do this, unless somebody's going to come up with a lot more savings than we have in this fiscal note today, I just don't think we're going to be able to do it. So we're either going to do it now or we're not going to be able to do it for, you know, I don't know how much longer, but.
Well, Senator Lynch.
Senator Sharon.
But when you're talking about doing it now, you're talking about making this appropriation, Senator Berglund.
For this biennium, we would be making an investment of $399,000. In order to generate a savings of $380,000. If you move it all over one column, mm-hmm. you're spending more than you're getting mm-hmm. over the four-year period.
Any additional questions?
So if you don't want to do this, it's okay with me. But if you think we should do this, then we should move ahead with this the way it is.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, I think we understand the numbers on this, but, you know, I'm really feeling pushed to, you know, make a decision on this one. I think there are a lot of policy questions and implementation questions and all of this that we haven't had a chance to talk about. And we've wrestled this committee with some pretty tough bills, and we wound up, you know, everybody landing on our feet and coming to some sort of agreement on how things work best. And that's my sense of tonight, is that we just haven't had a chance to really thoroughly discuss. We got the numbers, but how it's going to affect the Veterans Home, short-term and long-term implications, what it's going to do to the Deputy Commissioner's plan that he's on. I mean, the numbers tell the story. You're exactly right. You know, we've got to do it this year to realize any savings at all. But I think there's a lot of reluctance in the room because we haven't had a chance to have a discussion about what it means for the department and the home.
Members, I would just say that I feel like we've had lots of discussion on this, frankly. In fact, every time the Veterans Home comes to this division, it seems like we've had some discussion centering around this, and many other states are doing this, and I'm not seeing the downside. We have some serious issues with resources. We are seeking ways to strengthen those resources. We have had lots of discussion in this committee about many of the issues that have been very clearly identified in our homes. And so I see this as kind of a win-win. We get to some further assistance with some of the safety issues and concerns, quality issues that are out there, and we are seeking to get some help with some financial resources. And at the same time, according to this fiscal note, we're going to have some savings. I don't see the downside. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Berglund. And, you know, I guess I'm listening to this discussion and feeling a little bit torn because I can understand the concern about trying to be supportive of new administration, doing a good job and moving things in a better direction for the veterans' homes. On the other hand, it seems like if this is something we ultimately would want to do and if it's going to be good for veterans, the idea that we're going to put it $600,000 into something that will help veterans in such a tight fiscal year might want to be something the department takes advantage of, or they might have to somehow be able to do this ultimately without any additional assistance in terms of extra funding. So, I mean, this is an opportunity to get that funding to help veterans create something that may be beneficial that otherwise might have to happen without that additional funding. So, if it's the right thing to do and if there's any way to possibly do it, it would seem like it could be a win-win.
Madam Chair.
Assistant Commissioner Acevedo.
Senator Olson, the department would never turn away any funding that would benefit our veterans. But at the same time, we wouldn't go into an endeavor that we feel would not be safe and appropriate for our veterans either. So the amount of money that we're talking about that you are stating that would be given to the department as a win-win would probably put our veterans in harm's way. So I am concerned about that. I have tried to make statements stating that I don't feel that our staff is prepared. We've been held and taken to task accordingly. And if you look at our surveys at the Minneapolis home, they have shown drastic improvements. You look at all of our surveys at our homes, the things that we're putting together shows that we are moving in the right direction. But it just doesn't seem that we're being given the opportunity to move forward at the pace that we feel is appropriate. We would know, but I just don't think that is heard in this committee because, as I said before, I came from a certified Medicare facility. If I knew that our staff was ready to do this and we would not put our veterans in harm's way, I wouldn't even be arguing the point. I'm not saying that I'm opposed to Medicare certification. What I am saying is that the push and the timeline that we are being pushed at this point, I don't feel that it's right. And I think that there is a better way to do it. We're wanting to do the feasibility study. We're wanting to make sure that we're doing this right. If we submit application certification by law, October 2009, and CMS walks in the door a month later and we're not ready, and or we don't bring in the revenue that was suspected, the numbers that you're looking at is not our fiscal note. Our fiscal note shows a totally different number. And so that's basically the department's stance on that. We'll do what we're asked to do, but I just ask the committee that to think carefully because we want to do the right thing. And I know that there's no one in this room that wants to see our veterans in the newspaper and our veterans' homes in the newspaper again.
Okay. On that note, we've had a lot of discussion tonight. So, Senator Berglund, how would you like to proceed?
Well, I would move that Senate File 502 as amended be recommended to be included in the omnibus bill. And then let's just decide.
Senator Berglund has made a motion that Senate File 502 as amended be included in the omnibus bill. Any discussion? On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. I think we'll raise our hands on this one. So all those in the affirmative, if you would raise your hand. And all of those opposed, same sign. Okay. The motion is adopted. We had a desire to go back to Senator Dibble's bill. I don't see Senator Dibble in. I'm glad I asked. Senator Dibble, pardon me. Senator Dibble, please come forward once again with Senate File 1990.
Just keeping you company, really.
Madam Chair.
Welcome back.
So we took your suggestion to heart. I should say Senate Council took your suggestion to heart and developed the A2 amendment in which we established the Statewide Health Improvement Program Fund as a special account in the state treasury. And then we take the proceeds that we raise and we deposit those into the Statewide Health Improvement Program Fund. And then we go on to make appropriations out of that fund to the purposes that the bill describes. The $250,000 for a heart disease and stroke prevention unit at the Department of Health, $2 million in each year for the Statewide Health Improvement, for the Colorectal Cancer Prevention Program, $750,000 each year for the Women's Heart Health Program, about almost $48 million for the Statewide Health Improvement Program, SHIP, and then the balance, which I think would come to about $63 million to the Healthcare Access Fund.
Okay, would somebody like to move the amendment for Senator Dibble? Senator Sharon will move the A2 amendment. Any further discussion or any questions? Senator Rosen.
Just for the record, I would like to say, Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, I appreciate what you're doing here, but this is really hefty. And this is, I think the Healthcare Access Fund is probably what takes me out. And I wish it was just a little bit more reasonable with what is going on with the surrounding states. I think we're going to set ourselves up for some problems down the road. But so I cannot support the bill, but I appreciate your efforts.
Thanks. Madam Chair, I'll just appreciate the comments. I'll just also remind the committee, though, that by the studies that we've seen, we are paying about $8.85 per pack of cigarettes in health outcomes.
Any more discussion of the A2 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted. Any more discussion on the bill? This bill would need to go to taxes by way of the full finance committee before anything else can happen to it. So. Don't start counting your little nickels before they're hatched. Senator Lynch, I'll move the bill. Senator Lynch moves that Senate File 1990, as amended, be recommended to pass. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I believe that completes our agenda for tonight. We will not be having a meeting tomorrow due to the fact that we think maybe at most we might have one fiscal note. So we will not be meeting tomorrow, but we will be meeting the next day, we hope. With that, the meeting is adjourned.